So first, let me thank the organizers for setting up this beautiful conference and also for giving me the opportunity to present some of the results here. Today, I decided to tell you about something that is ML motivated, but which I think has some profound consequences for the way we think about machine learning and the way we optimize our models. And I'm going to try to tell you a story based on quantum state control and quantum state preparation, which is also relevant for quantum design and quantum computation. So in the last 2 years, I would say, reinforcement learning was established, or at least proposed, as a promising tool for quantum control. And this is possible because, essentially, quantum state preparation can be defined, can be formalized as fidelity optimization. And reinforcement learning is a machine learning tool, like many of the others, which actually optimize the performance of a given task. So I just want to show you a video where a reinforcement learning agent learns how to prepare a quantum state. So this is the block sphere. We have some initial state shown in green. We have some target state that we want to prepare shown in red. And the reinforcement learning agent is going to be constructing such a protocol sequence consisting of banks, positive banks and negative banks. So you see how it goes, you know, after something on the order of 14,000 learning episodes with no knowledge about the physical system, it figures out how to get pretty much into the target state. Now, this is one example. There's another example, which comes from out of equilibrium dynamics. So suppose now that I take a system that is a little bit more complicated than the qubit, which has a time dependence in such a way, a strong time dependence, in such a way that it's driven far away from equilibrium. And then on top of the time dependence, I will try to control, or my agent is going to try to control the system. So if you don't know what the Kapitza pendulum is, here's a video I found on YouTube from it. Oops, that video did not play. Yeah, we have to wait a bit. So you see the pendulum here. It has a stable equilibrium point and an unstable equilibrium point at the inverted position. So it's just, you know, a boring pendulum from classical mechanics. And then what now is going to happen here in this small experiment is the pivot point is going to be shaken vertically at a very high frequency. And I think if you look at it very carefully now, you can see that. What the periodic shaking does is it stabilizes the inverted position. So now the inverted position is stable, and it's also stable to small perturbations. So, you know, it performs oscillations. Now, I should say that this is an effect that is brought up solely due to the presence of the periodic drive. So at the moment the drive frequency is low enough, then we're going to lose that effect, and the pendulum is going to tip over. So, you know, the question is, can we use reinforcement learning for such systems, right? And yes, the answer is we can. So on the left, I'm showing you a simulation of the Kapitza pendulum, and similar to the video, my agent is going to be giving kicks to the pendulum, you know, a left kick or a right kick, and it should find the optimal sequence of those kicks. So you can see the kick direction here on the right. And after some amount of time, it prepares the state, and whenever we turn on the periodic drive, you know, the pendulum tips over, and of course, it comes back to the same position due to conservation of energy in my example. Well, we have the pendulum bob on the left, but, you know, we want to do quantum systems. And on the right, what I'm showing you is, if you wish, a smeared out version of that point pendulum, point particle. So this is essentially, this represents the wave function in real space as a function of that angle theta. And the idea, once again, is to try to invert the pendulum, but this time, you know, the wave function has many components, depending on which angle segment you look at, and it's not so easy to do the inversion perfectly. Nevertheless, the agent still succeeds in doing that. So looking at these examples and playing with the agent and with the reinforcement learning algorithm, there is something interesting that one notices, namely the ability to learn, the ability to succeed in doing these tasks actually depends strongly on the model parameters. And one such model parameter is, for example, the duration of the protocol sequence that we use. So instead of giving you a more kind of detailed introduction to reinforcement learning here, what I want to do is I want to use reinforcement learning in these videos to pose the following question. And the question is, you know, given that the agent, as I showed you, performs differently depending on the model parameters, the natural question to ask here would be, how easy or how hard is for the agent to learn? And in particular, can we give some sort of statistical mechanics interpretation on the easiness and the hardness? And to do that, I'm going to focus on a qubit chain First, I'm going to consider just a single qubit. I'm going to formulate the problem setup. And then I'm going to show you that the very process of preparing quantum states, of optimizing, of maximizing the fidelity, of optimizing cost function, is going to lead us to the notion of control phase transitions. So the very procedure of doing the optimization can undergo very sharp changes. So I'm going to show you that there's going to be an over-constrained phase, a correlated phase where optimization is actually very hard, and then there's going to be a controllable phase. This is just for a single qubit. Then we're going to, you know, I hope I'm going to have time, we're going to crank up the the complexity of the system. So first we're going to go to 2 qubits, and then I'm going to show you that the same model with just 2 qubits has, you know, apart from all these phases, an additional phase that has to do with symmetry breaking in the control landscape. And finally, we're going to go to the many-body system, which is, you know, completely intractable in this non-integrable model, and show you that the correlated glassy the correlated optimization landscape has actually a glassy complexity in that case. That is to say, it is very hard to find the bottom of the landscape. Yes. So I should say here that, you know, as my title says, these are transitions that I'm going to talk about in quantum control, and you can imagine that these happen not only in reinforcement learning, but they're also going to show up in any optimization problems. And since we know that in machine learning we train our models through optimization, then I think it, as physicists, it's actually quite interesting to try and understand, you know, how hard are these optimization problems themselves. Okay, so to kick off, let me define the problem setup. So let's consider a very simple two-level system. So here is a single qubit Hamiltonian with a constant Z field and a time-varying X field. And what I want is I want to start my system in an initial state psi I, which is given here by the green arrow on the Bloch sphere. And then what I also do is I define a target state psi star, which is the red state. And the idea is to find a protocol HFT, the time-dependent function, such that in a fixed amount of time, capital T, we can transfer the population of our quantum state from the initial to the target state. And just, you know, for reasons that are going to become clear later on in the talk, I will choose this protocol to be of the so-called bang-bang type. So it's only going to take values negative and positive 4. So this is very similar to the QAOA setup that we saw a couple of days ago. The only difference compared to QAOA is that I'm going to consider fixed time steps and a fixed total duration. And QAOA, one can vary the parameters in such a way as to find the maximum duration. So the way I'm going to be able to tell, or the way my agent was able to tell how well it did, was through measuring the fidelity. So the fidelity is just the overlap of the final state, so the time evolved state with that Hamiltonian, projected onto the target. So I consider here only pure states, so that this is the simplest of the setups. So what we want is we essentially want to maximize this fidelity. And sometimes during the talk, you might see this quantity 1 minus the fidelity, which I'm going to label the infidelity. So, you know, because we're physicists, we typically want to minimize landscapes and energies. But these are the same things. And for those of you who've never seen a fidelity before, this is nothing but the angle. I would say the infidelity is nothing but the angle between the two states in the Hilbert space. So that's the setup. Now, you're going to say, well, but if you want to go from the initial to the target state, really all you need to do is you need to follow the black dots here, right? So if I follow the black dots, then I get from the initial to the target right away. The only caveat is that following the black dots requires, as you can see here, a rotation about the y-axis, and there is no generator of y rotations in my Hamiltonian. So I have explicitly set up the problem in such a way that there are additional constraints on this optimization, just so that, you know, the single qubit is a very simple problem. We know how to solve it. So putting more constraints is going to be, you know, is going to give us a more interesting optimization problem. Now the other issue, the other constraint that I will put in here is, I'm going to put a cap, as I already said, on the value of the maximum value of the magnetic field that of the control field that I can use. Now, in principle, there is no such constraints, or it is not meaningful to impose such constraints on single particle systems. But remember, we really want to go and study a many-body system in the end. And in a many-body system, you just cannot have an extensive amount of energy at your disposal. Therefore, it's natural to, you know, to introduce some energy scale here. But now notice what happens. If I fix the total time and I also fix the total duration, the magnitude of the field, then it can happen that if the duration is not long enough, then I'm just physically not going to be capable of reaching the target state. So there is a, if you wish, a time, energy, uncertainty between how big of a field I give it and how long I can use that field for. And this leads us to the concept of the speed limit, or sometimes known as the quantum speed limit, which is the minimum time, the minimal duration, capital T, required to reach a target state. Okay, so this is a very simple problem. In fact, it is possible to compute exactly the optimal solution for this problem with all these constraints just because we have a single qubit. Now, I'm not going to show you how to do that because this is kind of, you know, fine-tuned, like in physics when we have like integrable systems where we know how, which we know how to solve. At the moment you go away to non-integrable systems, then you no longer, then these analytical methods no longer apply. So instead of that, I'm just going to show you the optimal protocol for a few different durations. So in one case, there's a duration of 0.5, duration of 1, and duration of 3.0. Remember, in units of the gap. So here are the optimal protocols, and on the right, just focus on this sphere here, B. You can see what happens on the block sphere. So if the duration is really too short, what happens is the state, you know, starts going down, and then eventually there is not enough time. So in order to minimize the angle with the target, what happens is it has to turn over, and one has one single sharp kink, essentially. On the other hand, if the time is a little bit longer, what's going to happen is the state, the agent is going to bring the state to the equator, and then this bang-bang sequence is essentially there to turn off the X field. So it's going to try to stay at the equator. This is because the equator is a geodesic. It's the only geodesic around the Z-axis that is available to the agent. And it's going to stay at the equator for as long as optimal, and then depart from it again, trying to reach the target. And what you saw in the movie on the first slide was eventually staying at the equator for literally as long as optimal, and then the time was enough to exactly hit the target. However, if the time given, you know, to the duration of the protocol given in the problem is longer than this minimum time, than this speed limit, what can happen essentially is that the agent or any other algorithm can in principle waste time, right? So it can do things that are uncorrelated, but nevertheless reach the target because there is just sufficient amount of time. So this is just, you know, how the solution to this problem looks like. But, you know, as I mentioned in the beginning, I'm not really interested in the solution here. I'm interested in how hard it is to get to the solution. And as I said, this actually affects the learning capability of the machine learning algorithm. So how do we approach this question? So let's just consider the family of bang-bang protocols, and I'm going to take this mapping where I take a protocol and I send it to the infidelity or to the negative fidelity. So this is a mapping from the space of protocols to, you know, the space of numbers between 0 and 1. This mapping defines the so-called optimization or infidelity landscape, where, you know, the optimization algorithm will be striving to find the better local minimum of that landscape. So one question that one can ask is, how much does a protocol that lives, say, in one local minimum, how much is it correlated with other protocols that live in other nearby local minima? So the question about, you know, how much do these protocols have to do with each other? And to study this problem, I'm just going to do the simplest thing ever. So I'm just going to, you know, take a protocol, start from any random protocol, and I'm just going to start changing the protocol banks in such a way until it gets stuck in a local minimum. And then I'm going to make sure that this is a local minimum by checking that any single flip is essentially increasing my infidelity. Of course, I can do this many times, starting from a different initial condition, and every time I'm going to get stuck in a different local minimum of that landscape. So then I'm going to connect these different protocols that correspond to the local minimum, and I call this sample H alpha. Then, as I said, what I'm interested in are correlations between these minima. So let me define a correlator function. To do that, the first thing we can do is we can take a protocol, we can take the sample, and we can just compute the mean over the sample. So just take, you know, the average over all possible elements of that sample. Notice that I'm not averaging over time, so I'm performing the average at a fixed point in time. And then once I have, and I call this H bar. And then once I have this, then I'm basically looking at the fluctuations of any fixed protocol from the mean of the sample. And then I'm going to also average these fluctuations over time. So that's the setup. Now, how does this look like as a function of the protocol duration? So Here, what you see is a plot where on the x-axis, I show different protocol durations. On the y-axis, I show a few different curves. Now, let's first focus on the blue curve. The blue curve is the best fidelity for that problem. As I mentioned to you, one can always compute the optimal fidelity for this problem. And if the protocol duration is long enough, because we're going to be above the speed limit, then we can always find the target state with 1.0 fidelity. Until we reach the speed limit, and when we reach the speed limit, then we can no longer reach 1.0 fidelity. It's not feasible, but nevertheless, you know, the fidelity drops continuously until, you know, the time duration zero, which is just the overlap of the initial and the target states. Now, more interesting is the behavior of the correlator Q of t, which is shown here in red. And before we discuss the behavior of the correlator, let me just give you an intuition of what this quantity measures. So suppose that my landscape has a single minimum. If it has a single minimum, then no matter how many times I'm going to drop the ball in that landscape, I'm always going to be finding that single minimum. Therefore, the average is essentially going to be superfluous. But if that's the case, I'm going to be subtracting from the protocol from itself, right? Therefore, Q is going to be zero. On the other hand, if the landscape of the minima, the set of the minima, is completely uncorrelated, then the average is going to be zero. And then I'm going to be left with the square of my protocol. But remember, my protocol was bang, bang, plus and minus 4. Therefore, when I square the protocol, I'm only going to get the same value no matter what. And the rest is just normalization. So once again, if I have no correlations in the landscape, then Q is going to be 0, is going to be 1. Whereas if I have a single minimum in the landscape, then Q is going to be 0. So if we now look at that curve, the red curve, we see that at short times, we indeed find a zero correlator Q. And then there is a critical duration at which correlations start building up in the landscape. And correlations build up until we reach exactly the speed limit, the minimum time. From there, eventually the landscape becomes uncorrelated. So this is kind of interesting, but what's more interesting here, at least to me, is that these points, TC and T min, are actually non-analytic points as a function of the protocol duration. So there is something interesting going on. It's as if we have some sort of phase transition, some sort of non-analyticity, but I'll need to argue why this is so and how one can think of it, in the landscape. And the reason why you could anticipate the phase transition here is that that object, the correlator that I defined for you, is very closely related to the Edwards-Anderson order parameter, which was initially introduced to measure spin glass physics. So how can we, you know, you can say, well, but, you know, just showing me a couple of kinks, is it enough to declare a phase transition, right? So there can be just something else going on, maybe some bifurcation or something like that in the landscape. So how can you think about that? So here's again a picture of the landscape. That's the system that I control. Here's my control field. Now every point on my landscape, I should say this is only a cartoon, right? This control landscape is very highly dimensional, so I can only draw it. It's even hard to map out. But every point on that landscape corresponds to one specific bang-bang protocol. And then what we are interested in is, let's say, the global minimum, because the global minimum corresponds to the optimal protocol in this infidelity landscape. Now, the global minimum might look something like that, where I have bangs as a function of time, and this is the optimal bang configuration. But on a good day, I can replace the bangs by classical spin degrees of freedom, and I can interpret these bang-bang protocols as spin states. Now, here's a place to say that these classical spins have nothing to do with my quantum qubits. So this is why I tend to call these qubits. These are the quantum degrees of freedom. In that case, I actually have a single quantum degree of freedom. But the number of classical spins, which essentially define this energy landscape together with the optimization problem, can be very large. And then if you were worried that, you know, you cannot have a phase transition in a system with a single degree of freedom, then you should actually look at the control degrees of freedom, because in the control space, you actually have a bunch of, you know, actually, let's say, nt degrees of freedom. And then what one can do is one can define a thermodynamic limit for that problem, where we send the number of degrees of freedom, the number of classical spins to infinity, and the time step to zero in such a way as to keep the total duration, capital T, constant. But now that I have, you know, an energy landscape, So to every spin configuration, I can define sort of an energy, that is to say an infidelity. Then the question is, you know, what is the underlying spin energy function? And this turns out to be a hard problem to answer. But what one can do is one can just, you know, write down an expansion of that function. So there's going to be some free term, there's going to be some single particle term, some two-body interaction, three-body interaction, and so forth. And notice that the spin degree of freedom here is just my protocol. So even though I started with a single qubit degree of freedom, I end up with an optimization problem that is that actually has many, many degrees of freedom. And in particular, it is a complicated interacting problem. What I'm hopefully going to have time to show you later, a little bit later in the talk, is that we actually have all possible body interactions, and they're all important, in the phase where we found that the correlator has non-zero or non-unity value. So there's going to be like this complicated phase of optimization where everything, you know, all of these couplings are going to play a significant role. So far, so good. This was a single qubit. But I also promised you to show you slightly more complicated systems, right? So we wanted, in the end, to study this multi-qubit spin control. So let's just, you know, increase the complexity of the quantum system by one and add another degree of freedom. So now I'm going to consider two coupled qubits. So if I have two coupled qubits, my Hamiltonian is essentially the same as before. This time, I will assume that my bang-bang control field is a global control field. That is to say, with a single control field, I want to, you know, manipulate both qubit degrees of freedom. And these degrees of freedom will be interacting with some strength that is normalized to 2 here. So here are, again, the quantities that I defined before. So the question is, how does the two-qubit control phase diagram look like? And similar to before, we find that at short protocol durations, the correlator Q, which is shown here in red, is basically zero or goes to zero in the thermodynamic limit. We also find that at long durations, it is possible to prepare the state, the target state. The target state here, sorry, I forgot to say, the target state is the ground state of the interacting Hamiltonian at, you know, a field of negative 2, so same as before. And the initial state is the ground state of the interacting Hamiltonian at the field of positive 2. But so we have the overconstrained phase where, you know, we have a single minimum in the landscape. We have the uncorrelated phase where it's essentially very easy to find the minimum that prepares the protocol. And there's many of those because, remember, my agent can waste time. But then there's something interesting happening in the correlated phase. So correlations initially start building up until some intermediate point in the correlated phase. And then this correlator just jumps. So there is a discontinuity in the correlator. Until, again, it gets to the point where we find a kink. And it turns out that this continuity has to do with symmetry breaking in the control landscape. So we can distinguish between two correlated phases, one that is correlated and symmetric, and one that is correlated and symmetry broken. It is not because the fidelities that you get for a fixed protocol will depend on the dynamics. That is to say, they will depend on your Hamiltonian. Well, again, with the only difference that in one case you have non-interacting qubit, and the other case you have two interacting qubits. Oh, you're asking me whether the protocol is the same, the optimal protocol is the same. No, it's not going to be the same. The couplings, these JIJs, they are not going to be the same. They change if I change my Hamiltonian. Same model, different couplings, exactly. And this is where the change is coming from. But there is something peculiar about this symmetry breaking that we can discuss if there's time that I personally do not understand. But the question is, you know, how can we understand this symmetry breaking? Before I go there, you know, the data that I showed just was not particularly smooth, right? But once again, remember the thermodynamic limit in the problem here in the classical spin model is where I take the time step to zero and the number of spins to infinity. So you see how this becomes essentially a jump and how this becomes a kink. So you have to go, you know, deep enough in the thermodynamic limit to be able to see those transitions in certain cases. Okay, so how can we understand symmetry breaking? So it just so happened that the initial and the target state that I chose were fine-tuned. This happened kind of by chance, but this is a fine-tuning phenomenon. So the initial and the target state are related by a global rotation about pi. Now, that's fine because this is not an allowed rotation within my family, because you know, I cannot just rotate about the global Z field. There's always going to be the interacting part of that Hamiltonian, even if I cancel the control. So this, you know, is not an available solution, but nevertheless, the two states are related by that. Then one can do a simple calculation, and the algebra is going to show that the fidelity of any protocol HFT for a given duration, capital T, is the same as the fidelity of the flipped protocol traversed backwards in time. So this is just, you know, a consequence of that Z2 symmetry. But if that's the case, then from this relation, there's only two possibilities. Either the protocol, the optimal protocol, is unique and symmetric, symmetric meaning that HFT is equal to negative HF capital T minus T, or it, you know, is symmetry broken and doubly degenerate. So these are the two possibilities. And this is the case basically always throughout the phase diagram, but what happens is, you know, exactly at that particular point, one can observe this transition to a symmetry broken landscape. One can also look at the effective spectrum of the spectrum of the effective Hamiltonian. And the interesting thing that you see as a function of the protocol duration is that close to the transition, of the symmetry breaking transition, there are these merging. So states become degenerate in that model, and this is how we can see the onset of the transition. Now, because you know we have a symmetry breaking phenomenon, we know from StatMech that we can define an order parameter for that phase transition. This is just, you know, the magnetization, the net sum, the net, if you wish, polarization of a protocol. But of course, you know, this is not a phenomenon that only happens for the ground state. So typically when we talk about symmetry breaking in the context of the Ising model in statistical physics, then we talk about low energy physics. Now here, I am talking about low energy in the sense that I'm discussing the low infidelity part of the landscape, but I have no notion of temperature. So in order to do the statistical averaging, I'm going to use my sample that I introduced before. So the sample of the local minima in the landscape. And then you can look at the magnetization order parameter. You see how it's going to be zero up to the symmetry broken phase. And then it starts building up, and this is again like a sharp transition if you do the scaling. So what are the implications of this symmetry breaking for physics in the first place? Like, is it interesting? Like, can we observe it in reality? And the answer is yes, we can. So let me do a scatter. So okay, what I can do is I can take a protocol, you know, one of these local minima that I have computed, and then I can evolve my system with that protocol, right? And once I have my final state, what I can do is, you know, I can compute the fidelity, and I showed you that quantity already, but what I can also do is I can compute now the entanglement between the two qubits. This is another quantity. And then I can do this for every single protocol. So what I show you here on the left is a scatter plot of these protocols in entanglement entropy infidelity space. So the optimal protocol is basically here on the left on the x-axis, and this is the corresponding entanglement of the final state, you know, obtained by evolution with each of those protocols. So if we are at the protocol duration that is below the symmetry breaking transition, then we basically see a big blob. But at the moment we go across the transition, then some of those states transition, you know, to lower energies. And not only do they transition to lower energies, but then we can clearly see the symmetry breaking appearing. That is to say, there is now an entanglement gap. So we cannot distinguish these states in terms of fidelity, because this is how they are defined, that these protocols have the same fidelity, but we can distinguish them, for example, by entanglement. And then if you, you know, go deeper into the entanglement phase, then essentially, you know, the low infidelity landscape will consist entirely of those two parts. Now you can say, well, but entanglement is not necessarily easy to measure, but it doesn't matter. I can take any observable, because, you know, I have two solutions that are degenerate and are different. I'm always going to have different final states. And so you can see that any observable that I measure is going to show something like a small bifurcation in a finite region of the capital duration. So this is how one can try and observe these things in experiment. OK. So I showed you the single spin. I showed you the two spin problem. Now let's, you know, like do the complicated problem. So now let's do the many body spin system. And the many-body spin system is just this transverse field Ising model, but I additionally have a parallel field. And what this parallel field does for me is it actually makes the model non-integrable. So there is no closed-form solution for the eigenstates and eigenenergies for any fixed value of Hx. And now what I'm actually looking for is the best protocol, you know, out of an exponentially large family of protocols. So this is kind of a complicated problem to study. It is not known what the optimal protocol for this system is, and there is no way of verifying that something is an optimal protocol. So this is a typical situation that you would encounter in machine learning. You have your landscape, you have your problem, you're trying to minimize, and you see how far you get. The only thing you can do is you can compare two solutions and see which one is better. So the initial and the target state, once again, are going to be the ground state of this whole Hamiltonian at, you know, X field negative 2, and then the target state is going to be at an X field positive 2. So it is important that both states are within the same phase. So this model has phase transitions. If I talk about ground states, you know, there will be some order. So these both states are paramagnetically ordered. So I'm not crossing any phase transition here. Even though, okay. And once again, you know, the protocol is doing the same bangs between minus 4 and positive 4, and we have this classical spin degree of freedom. Total time is fixed. So here is what the agent did for that protocol, so back to RL. Now, it is very hard to visualize a many-body spin system, and I'm going to sort of use a trick. The trick that I will use is I will make the system translationally invariant, and if this is the case, what I can do is I can trace out all the spins but one, and what I do is I'm going to get the reduced density matrix for that single, qubit, and I can then plot the dynamics of that reduced density matrix on the block sphere. Now, you're going to say, well, which one? Well, here's where the trick enters. It doesn't matter which one I leave because I assume translation invariant. So if you wish, they all dance in the same way. What can happen here in this simulation, in contrast to the single qubit one, is that because this is now a reduced density matrix, the pointer, the state, can actually go inside the sphere if the state gets entangled. So this is what the agent found after 5,000 iterations. So you see, it is kind of noisy, but in the end, you know, it brings it to the target, and nevertheless, there are these dotted lines, and I hope to be able to come to this and tell you where they come from. The other important point here to make is that once we have a many-body system, the fidelity of our model is going to, you know, naturally reduce exponentially, and therefore we're looking at the log fidelity, even though the optimization is done either with the log fidelity or the fidelity, because the log is a monotonic function. Okay. So how does the phase diagram look like now for the interesting, complicated case? Well, rather surprisingly or disappointingly, there's only two phases, or maybe two and a half. But the over-constrained phase is there. So the phase where I have too many constraints and, you know, there's a single optimal solution I can find. And then I very quickly enter the correlated or glassy phase. And there is no sign of symmetry breaking. There is also, more interestingly, no sign of controllability, even though my fidelity, which is the curve that I'm showing you here, can reach close to 1.0. It's never exactly at unit fidelity. That is to say, the speed limit value is pushed out to later and later times. And in the thermodynamic limit, most likely, it's even sent out all the way to infinity. Now, as before, I want to also show you the correlator Q, but here, because of the data is a little bit more noisy, it is more interesting to look at another quantity, which is just the fraction of unique local minima. So remember, the correlator has this complicated average, but here I do something cheaper, which is just, you know, I have my sample, so let me just, you know, compute the fraction of unique local minima compared to all of them. So here's how the correlator in blue looks like. Here is how the fraction in blue dashed line looks like. So again, this fraction, you know, in the beginning, all the minima are the same because there's a single minimum. But then very quickly, in the correlated phase, I get to 1.0. Now, this is done on a set of minima that is obtained by doing one flips at a time. So I do one flip at a time, then I can reevaluate my fidelity, and then I check whether I got better, and so forth. But what you can imagine is a more sophisticated flipping algorithm where you flip where you do two flips at a time, right? And if you do two flips at a time, something interesting happens, namely that transition from, you know, a over-constrained, a simple phase and a correlated phase shifts a little bit. And you can see this more clearly by looking at the fraction of local minima. Now the question is, okay, so, you know, this is like the one flip update, this is the two flip update. What if I do like a four flip update? If I do a four flip update, it shifts again. And interestingly, this is the last time it shifts. So from here on, you know, any more non-local update is not going to lead to a significant shift in the energy. And that is to say that you know, there are further instances of reorganization in the landscape that really depends on how we explore it. Okay. Now, can we visualize this glassy transition? So if, you know, finding the optimal protocol in this many-body spin system is actually very hard, is, you know, is as hard as a glassy state, then, you know, what signatures of such a glassy transition can we detect? And in machine learning, there is usually a useful tool to do that. And this tool is Tisny. So what Tisny does is it's essentially a clustering algorithm. So it's an embedding of a high-dimensional data set into a low-dimensional manifold. One thing that's important that happens during this embedding is that we lose the notion of distance. And therefore, what I'm going to be showing you here is, you know, sort of cluster images, but without any numbers on the axis because there is no notion of a distance. So then what I can do is I can take a very simple approach where I can sample a whole bunch of my minima, and then I take all these local minima and I try to cluster them. And I'm going to show you four images at different protocol durations across this correlated phase transition. So what happens is, at very short durations, we have a single minimum. Therefore, we find, you know, like just one point in that space. So all of those minima are the same. Now, as I approach the transition, I find different clusters of protocols. And in every cluster, this is what the color scheme here is showing. In every cluster, the fidelity that corresponds to the different points, you know, different protocols, can slightly vary. But, you know, make sure that you notice this factor here. The deviation is really not that small, not that big. So it's actually a really tiny deviation. Nevertheless, what you can show is that protocols that live within the same cluster have actually a small Hamming distance. That is to say, they are close together in a certain sense, whereas protocols that live in different clusters are very far away from each other. In particular, they're also far away in terms of, you know, the number of bits of dates that I do on my state in order to improve the cost function, the infidelity. So as I continue going through the phase transition, it seems first that all of these clusters merge to a single big blob. But, you know, keep in mind here what I mentioned, that, you know, Tisny loses the notion of distances. Each of those points here, if you zoom in, is actually a cluster for itself. So in other words, you know, what we get is the number of clusters between which we can go, you know, like from with our flip updates, grows from an extensive number, linear number in the number of bits to an exponential number in the number of bits. And you can actually do this statistical analysis and show that indeed there are exponentially many clusters in the correlated phase. And therefore, we believe that this correlated phase has a similar complexity as ordinary glassy phases, even though there is no typical disorder in our model, right? So everything is deterministic in our classical spin Hamiltonian. So here's another example of you know, some other properties of this effective Hamiltonian. So, you know, there's this classical energy function, but what I can also do about this classical function is I can compute the density of states. And the density of states as a function of infidelity is shown here in this dashed line for two times, one below, so in the easy phase, and one in the hard phase. So once again, this is an infidelity axis. The best protocol is going to be on the leftmost protocol here on that axis. So now what I can do is I can take 28 spins, not so many, but, you know, 28 spins. I can compute all 268 million different protocols and the associated energies or fidelities, right? And then what I can do is I essentially can order them, and I can start now from my global minimum, from the best protocol. Once I have the best protocol, then the question is that I'm going to ask is the following. If I just do one flip update, so I consider the one spin one flip excitations, how much of an infidelity do I lose, right? So the one flip excitations are shown here in red with red circles. You see that in the easy phase, you do a one flip excitation, and you have to, you know, like see how many protocols do I have around these fidelities, the fidelities of the one flip excitations, and you can see that in the easy phase there's about 100 protocols that are one flip away from the protocol. Therefore, if you, you know, do a mistake, then you can easily find the ground state again. However, if you go in the correlated phase, then the number of protocols surrounding the one flip excitations is already a million. And therefore, the probability of going actually to the finding the ground state is much harder. What does it mean for our optimization procedure? It means that as I start, and I typically start, you know, from the high density of states part of the spectrum, as I start optimizing, and I, you know, my algorithm is going to start minimizing. If I miss, you know, one of these 28 out of a million good protocols, and I continue optimizing, there is no way with a single flip to get to the ground state. So I'm definitely bound to get stuck in a local minimal. I can never get to the global one. I can ask the question, well, what about if I do two flips? And as I showed you already with the correlator, so the two flips at this time, you know, allow you to get to the ground state. So the easy phase extends, right? However, if you look at the later times, then those green crosses, the two flip excitations are also going to move to later times. And again, they're going to move in the region of high density of states. There was a question about the couplings. So what one can also do, since you know we have all energies now, is we can exactly determine all these couplings. So you know the G, the J, and the K. And one interesting thing is, you know, how do the two-body interactions look like? You know, so these are the two-body interactions on the time lattice. So these are now the protocol time steps. How do these interactions look like as a function of the protocol duration? Unfortunately, 28 spins are not enough to see any signature of the transition. But we find something else. We find that their color is largely the same. In particular, the color of neighboring spins is largely the same, which basically means that the ground state is going to be highly frustrated. And this is where some of the complexity is coming from. This is where some of the similarity to glassy physics is coming from. OK, so do I have two more minutes? OK, let me just show you on the last slide. You know, so this is a lot of numerical work, but can we gain some physical understanding about it? Like, can we build some sort of variational theory for these low-lying protocols? And the answer is yes. So consider the black line here. The black line is the optimal protocol for time duration 1.0. And I can mimic that protocol. I can make an ansatz which has only three pulses, one positive, one negative, and all these symmetric banks, I set them to average out to zero. So you might think that there's three different lengths that I need to find, and this would be the case for QAUA. But here, because I fixed the protocol duration, I actually have only two. Two pulse lengths to find, and then I'm also going to assume that symmetry. Therefore, there's going to be a single variational parameter, so to speak, that defines the form of my protocol. And then, you know, one-dimensional manifold I can easily minimize, and then I can compare in dashed line the variational fidelity to the best fidelity that. Again, not the optimal, because I don't know what the optimal is, but the best that I found by other means. And you see that there's a fairly good agreement in the beginning, and then, you know, at later times, like 2.0, something weird happens with that ansatz. But now we can look at how the protocol looks like at 2.0. And what you see is, you know, this basically beautiful structure. So a second pulse appears that we need to take into account, and then there's again a huge mess, and the huge mess I set to zero. So now I have two parameters, and I do the variation. And what you find is an excellent agreement all the way up to durations of, you know, like 3.0. So I didn't mention this, but these protocol durations are so small. This is exactly the opposite of any adiabatic regime. So like before, you know, the physics here that I'm discussing, you know, takes place very far away from the adiabatic limit. The interesting thing, or, you know, the final plot that I want to show is, you know, how does the optimal length look like as a function of the duration? So what you see is that, you know, in the optimal length, you can find a kink. You can find those kinks. And in the one variational parameter family, there is a single kink. In the two parameter variational family, there's two kinks. And these kinks miraculously correspond exactly to the position of those transitions. So there is a signature of those transitions already at the level of, you know, a very simple model. And exactly because of this, these transitions are completely insensitive to, you know, the positions of the transitions are insensitive to the algorithm that I apply. I mean, these are properties of the landscape, not properties of the way I explore the landscape. Even though when you study glassy physics, you have to be careful, as I showed you. Yes, okay. And yeah, okay, so these are exactly those points, right? So the critical point, this kink, corresponds exactly to the point of that transition. And then there's something like another kink building up, which corresponds to the two flip transition, which could be captured by that one, by that point here. Okay, so this is pretty much everything I wanted to tell you about. So I, you know, there's a lot of open questions here, and there's very few things I would say that we understand, but I just want to mention that similar control phase transitions have already been observed in protocols minimizing work fluctuations. So this has now nothing to do with quantum systems, right? This is completely classical physics. Then I guess an interesting question for further studies, you know, what is the relation to case satisfiability problems? Because phase transitions have been known to occur in case satisfiability problems for quite some time now. What is the underlying reason for the symmetry breaking that I showed you for two qubits? I have no idea. Because, you know, the symmetry could have been broken for a single qubit. It could have been broken for, you know, 4, 6, 10, 12, 16 qubits, but it just doesn't. It only gets broken for two qubits. And why? I don't know. And in general, you know, how can we understand the success of RL playing board games, you know, when we already know that, you know, typically there are regimes where these landscapes, the optimization landscapes, are highly correlated. That is to say, you know, this is just to raise the question of whether, you know, AlphaGo and AlphaZero are finding the best solution, or they're just finding, you know, just a superhuman performance. Okay, so thank you very much for the attention. Happy to take questions.
So we got time for about one question.
Okay, thank you for the talk. And I'd like to ask, like, two questions. The first is, does the variational approach capture the symmetry breaking?
Yes, it does. So what you can do is you can define a variational protocol which can break the symmetry, mm-hmm. but does not have to. And then you find exactly that it breaks the symmetry in pretty much the right point.
Okay.
Yeah, so you can capture that.
And the second question would be about the fact that you say that for the many-body system, you do not find anymore the phase where the system is controllable.
Yes, okay. And I believe this is the case.
Okay.
And I think that for any, actually, so the statement that I want to make is the following. For any finite size system, there will be a long enough time, maybe on the order of maybe bigger than the system size, where you could get a 1.0 fidelity, but not in the thermodynamic limit.
Okay, but not in the thermodynamic limit, okay. And
but that's a guess, that's not the proof. I don't have any evidence.
Okay. In the picture you showed, does however the scaling change in some region?
So the interesting...
with the time, I mean the scaling of the infidelity with the time, does it change drastically?
So with the... So first of all, the infidelity changes with the time. The longer you give it to, the closer it gets to unity, yeah. Right? But I guess there's also an interesting question of, you know, how does the infidelity change with the function of the system size, the infidelity for the best protocol, and the best that you could find. And here you see that it doesn't change on an exponential scale. That is to say, the log fidelity remains constant already, you know, like there's almost no difference between 8 and 10 qubits, and you can go to 16 qubits. The log fidelity for the optimal protocol in this problem remains there. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't go down.
Okay.
The fidelity itself will go down, but this is a typical...
Yeah, you know, because of the many-body. Yeah, sure,
exactly,
sure.
The many-body aspect.
Okay. Thank you.
Nice. So I think we have coffee break now, right? So let's thank the speaker again and go have some coffee.